We left off with Moses having killed an Egyptian and being found out by others. And now we see Moses is on the run. And in verse 15 of Exodus chapter 2, it says, "But when Pharaoh heard of this matter, he sought to kill Moses. But Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well." And you know, water was very scarce in that region, so finding a well to rest by would have been an incredible blessing from the Lord to Moses at this point. And this is a place that Moses would find some refuge. And it's interesting how the Lord led Moses in this direction to find refuge. And we'll see that as the story continues. But imagine what it must have been like for Moses, having been raised in the comforts and the blessing of Egypt, you know, being raised in the palace by Pharaoh's daughter. And this same Pharaoh was now casting him out and trying to kill him. This would be like your grandfather trying to kill you. That's what it's like. It would have been like, I'm sure, like a father to him. And he's running away from his family. He's being cast away. But Moses had a call in his life. And I believe, in fact, we know according to Hebrews chapter 11 that he knew that he had a call in his life at that point. In fact, in Hebrews 11, it says, "By faith, Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he looked to the reward. By faith, he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible." So this was a walk of faith that Moses was going through. It doesn't seem like it as we read the book of Exodus here, because he's fleeing from the face of Pharaoh. But even within fleeing, there is faith. And Moses was a man of faith. He knew the Lord's hand was on his life. Now, the book of Acts tells us that he was 40 years old at this time. And Moses' life breaks up into a very simple three sections. The first 40 years in Egypt, the next 40 years in the backside of the desert, and the next 40 years in moving the children of Israel through the wilderness toward the promised land. Now Moses, you know, we could look at this as he's 40 years old and we could say, you know, was Moses in a midlife crisis? And he literally was, not because of emotional problems like most men. He was in a literal, real crisis. And I'm sure that at this point, Moses is feeling very alone and rejected as he leaves and he heads to this place and he finds this well and he sits down by this well. I'm sure that Moses is not, you know, doing really well with all of this. I mean, he's human. And it tells us there that a priest of Midian had seven daughters, verse 16. And they came and drew water and they filled troughs to water their father's flock. Then the shepherds came and drove them away, but Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. You know, this is one of the best things that you can do when you're feeling alone and rejected is to serve the Lord, to serve others, really, to reach out and just serve other people. And we can see that Moses had a heart for people. He helps these women who've come to water their flock, and he waters their flock. Now, we don't know who these shepherds were. They didn't want to share the water. They were water mongers. And they didn't want to share the water with these daughters of this priest of Midian. Now, by the way, you pose the question, who was this priest of Midian? We'll see in the next verse. It says, they came to their father, to Reuel, their father, and said, how is it you've come so soon today? I mean, he surprised their home so early. Now, by the way, Reuel means friend of God. And later, we know that this guy is called Jethro because he becomes Moses' father-in-law. But Jethro is probably a title. You know, we take it on as a name. Of course, the Beverly Hillbillies, they have it. But Reuel is his name, and it means friend of God. And they said, an Egyptian delivered us from the hand of the shepherds, and he also drew enough water for us and watered the flock. Here we see this priest of Midian, a man named Reuel. Now, he is likely a descendant. The Midianites were descendants of Abraham through his second wife, Keturah. And they probably were really followers of Jehovah because, of course, Abraham would have had influence upon his family. And because of that connection with Abraham, it's reasonable to assume he was a true priest and a worshiper of the true and living God. And isn't it wonderful that God would take Moses to this place, to this well, at this time in his life? And isn't it so true that when we are in dire straits in our life, When we're in places that are dry and difficult and struggling and not knowing where to go and what to do, the Lord will always have his people. He will always have those who will come alongside. You know, this could have been anybody at this well, but it's these seven daughters of a godly man, a priest of Midian. And in Egypt, you know, Moses enjoyed the life of a royal family. And now, he was waited on hand and foot. Now, he's in this position where he sees a need, and he steps into that need. He did a good job, too, working hard to help water the flocks of the daughters of Jethro, Reuel. And he's accepted into the family of the priest. Look what it says. Now, so to the daughters, he said, this is the father, he said, where is he? Why is it that you have left the man? Call him that he may eat bread. You know, he's got seven daughters. He's thinking, and you let a man in the desert get away? What's the matter with you guys? How did this happen? You know, I think he really wanted to find a son-in-law for at least one of them. And he does end up doing that, we know. And Moses was content to live with the man, and he gave Zipporah, his daughter, to Moses, and she bore him a son, and he called his name Gershom, for he said, I have been a stranger in a foreign land. Moses was content to live with the man. In taking a wife and having a child, and he'll have another child later on, Moses seems to sort of give up on Egypt. Maybe his hope of being the deliverer and this call in his life was waning. He's going to settle down in Midian, content with where God put him in life, even though Midian was very different from Egypt. You know, and being content is an important thing, that you come to a place where Paul said, I've learned in all things, whether it be whether I'm abased, whether I'm blessed, whether everything's wonderful in my life, I've learned to be content. And contentment is a very valuable thing. And I believe that God was taking Moses to a place of contentment for a season. You know, it's interesting that his son's name means stranger in a strange land. That's how Moses felt about his life right now. I'm a stranger in a strange land. I don't fit anywhere. I don't fit in Egypt. I don't fit in Midian. That's really what he's saying. I've been kicked out of Egypt and I'm in Midian. And, you know, we think of these years of Moses were sort of just years of waiting for God. And in one sense they were, but in another sense they were years of working too. You know, Moses is going to work harder than he's ever worked in his life as he becomes a shepherd. Remember, he had all the comforts of the palace in Egypt, but now God's training him. He's shaping him for his future calling. Moses was going to become a shepherd. Imagine how important that would become when he's herding 2.5 million people through the desert. That would become a very valuable thing. Herding people is a lot like herding sheep. I have one friend who says he feels sometimes when he's dealing with people, it's like herding cats. Herding sheep is one thing. Herding cats is another thing. You ever try to herd a cat? Try to get a cat to do what they don't want to do. Forget about that. Now, from verses 22 to verse 23, 40 more years go by. This is a fast section here. We just covered 40 years. And when we come to this and we look at these next verses, God's going to reveal himself to his people through all that he's about to do. And Moses had all the degrees from Egypt. He had all the PhDs, all the background from Egypt. Remember, he was learned in all the ways in Egypt, it tells us in the book of Acts. And God could have used that if he wanted to, this great man of God, but he chooses to use a broken vessel instead. And now he will take a shepherd out of the desert with a couple of kids and a wife and call him to deliver his people. When the work is done that way, you know who gets the glory? Not the guy with the PhD on the back of his name, but the Lord gets the glory. We think of others that are called this way, you know, out of the desert. You know, you might be feeling like you're in a bit of a desert experience even in your life right now. Moses gets called from the backside of the desert to go and become the deliverer for the nation of Israel. You know, and John the Baptist was called out of the wilderness. Paul the Apostle spent years in the deserts of Arabia. John the Apostle spent his time on the island of Patmos. And David fled from Saul in the wilderness in Gedi. God calls us from the wilderness. He calls us from the deserts, the desert places at times. Because in the desert place, in the dry place, in the wilderness, that's a lot of times when we learn our best lessons. We really grow. We really have the work of God worked into our lives. So verse 23, 40 years later, now it happened in the process of time that the king of Egypt died. Then the children of Israel groaned because of the bondage, and they cried out. And their cry came up to God because of the bondage. So God heard their groaning. And God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac and Jacob. God looked upon his children, upon the children of Israel, and God acknowledged them. So Pharaoh, the Pharaoh that Moses was running from, he dies. And you know, we see this, and we see that it says God remembered Israel. And it's not like God forgot Israel. Let's make that clear. You know, God never forgets. He chooses not to remember some things. He says, I remember your sins no more. That's choosing not to remember. That's not forgetting. There's a difference. God cannot forget. But what this means is that God actively turns his attention to them. And he did this because of the covenant that was made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The covenant he had with this people. He chooses, not because they're so lovable, you know. It's not like God looked down and said, oh, I just love those little Jewish people. Oh, aren't they cute? You know, that's not it. It tells us that God looked on them and God knew them. He acknowledged them in verse 25. He looked on them. He saw them and they were crying out and they were groaning. And if you're a parent, you have children and your children cry out to you, man, your heart gets tugged. Your heart gets pulled to them, and you just want to run to them as fast as you can. You would take the pain upon you as quickly as you could. And I think that's the heart of God toward the children of Israel. He wants to help them. He's hearing their call. I remember when my daughter Tiffany, when she was only 16, I think she was, 16 or 17, she was traveling to Austria to go away to Bible college. And she was carrying with her guitar and certain things. She had a lot of luggage. And we were not sure if she would make her connection with the train. She was landing in Munich, Germany, and she needed to make a train to head off into Austria. And there was only two trains, and one was right away when she landed, pretty close to when she landed. The other one was several hours later. So we told her, well, you know, whatever happens, Tiff, if you don't make your train, call us and let us know, and let us know everything's okay. You know, because, you know, here she is traveling all by herself into a foreign land. I mean, you know, I know we're crazy parents. We let her do it. And she was our first one going out, too. So it was really like this, you know, thing, you know. So sure enough, in the middle of the night, the phone rings. My wife answers the phone, and there's nobody on the line. And I take the phone from her. Give me that phone. And I get on the phone. I say, hello, hello. And here's what I hear on the other end of the phone. Daddy, 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 daddy. And I'm like, okay, let me just jump through the phone and go and just let me be with her right now and help her, right? And I said, Tiff, what's the matter? Is it okay? What's the matter? She said, oh, I just couldn't make a phone call and it was so hard. I'm like, oh, you're killing me, you know, right now. And she had had some trouble and things when she landed, but I just remember feeling like, oh no, something happened to her. And imagine the Lord, when the children of Israel are crying out, God remembered them. He looked on them. He knew them. He loved them. He cared for them. And this is how a parent cares for children, and so much more than that, that the Father God loved his children, loves his children. And don't you know he cares for you in the same way? That when you cry out to him, when you're in need, when you have a burden, you have something going on in your life, he hears you, and he wants to answer your prayer, and he wants to meet you there because he loves you. And so we see now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the back of the desert. By the way, that's the first time the word desert is used in the Bible. And he came to Horeb, the mountain of God. By the way, this mountain, Mount Horeb, is believed to be where Mount Sinai would become, and it's in Saudi Arabia. There's a lot of dispute about this, and I'm actually trying to get this couple that I met a number of years ago, Jim and Penny Caldwell, and I'm going to try and get them to come and share with us their discoveries and their theories on the location of Mount Sinai. Wouldn't that be a wonderful thing to have a presentation like that? They do a great job. So I'm going to try and get them here during our study in the book of Exodus, and you guys on Wednesday night will get blessed to see them, and maybe some other people will actually come out too. But anyway, so the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire from the midst of a bush. So he looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, but the bush was not consumed. Now, when you've spent 40 years on the backside of the desert, not much happens out there. So a bush that was burning would be pretty exciting. It would break up the monotony. You know, sheep herding, handling sheep, you know, you got to do a few things, but once you do, they're grazing in the field, they're doing their thing, and you're spending a lot of time just kind of sitting around looking at cactus. And so he looks and he sees this bush that was burning. Now, bush burning would not have been that out of the ordinary, because spontaneous combustion within the desert with these types of bushes could very easily happen. This word for bush, by the way, is a thorn bush. And so this wouldn't have been that unusual to see a bush burning, but would have been highly unusual is several other things about this bush. First of all, a bush that was burning and was not being consumed. Because, you'd imagine that if a bush caught on fire with spontaneous combustion, it would have to be pretty dry in that region for that to happen, right? Which would mean the bush would burn up pretty quickly, and it would just kind of go, and it would be done pretty fast. But this must have been quite a sight. When he turned, he looked at the bush, and he saw the bush was burning, and he kind of imagined Moses looking at it going, oh, there's a burning bush. I haven't seen one of those in a while. And then sort of going, yeah, that's a little different burning bush. Yeah, that bush is burning, but it's not being consumed. And you got to remember, Moses is the one who wrote this down. So this is an eyewitness testimony here. It must have been quite a sight. And Moses said, I will now turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush does not burn. So he notices, he sees this. And he gives his attention to this great sight, a burning bush that is not consumed. And this gets his attention. That would get your attention, wouldn't it? Would get mine. And God will draw our attention in ways, will he not? There's times when God will cause something to happen that sort of seems just so out of the ordinary to our life. And it's like, Lord, why is this happening? And Moses isn't sort of questioning. He's just sort of like, Lord, what's going on? That's a bush that's not burning. What is this about? And many times we have things like that in our life, which are sort of just things that make us scratch our heads and say, what is this about? What are you trying to do here, Lord? When that happens, what we need to realize is the Lord wants to get our attention. He wants us to pay attention to him. Moses is going to do that very thing. And it says, when the Lord saw that he turned aside to look. Notice those words. When the Lord saw that he turned aside to look. In other words, when the Lord noticed that he was paying attention, and when the Lord notices you're paying attention, he's going to want to speak to you and to me also. And God called to him from the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, here I am. The second thing that was unusual about this bush was the Lord spoke to him from the bush. That's unusual. It's one thing to have a bush that's burning. It's another thing to have a bush that's burning and not consumed. It's another thing entirely when the bush starts talking to you. And not only was the bush talking to him, he turns to give his attention and it speaks to him. And he will. And the Lord doesn't speak to him, by the way, until he gives his attention. But the third thing is that he knew Moses' name. I mean, this must have blown Moses' mind. Again, it's one thing when a bush is burning. It's another thing when a bush is burning and not consumed. It's another thing when a bush is burning and speaks to you. But it's another thing entirely when a bush is burning and speaks to you and says your name. Right? Moses may have been a forgotten man in Egypt. 40 years has gone by. The other pharaoh's dead. I'm sure everybody's forgotten all about Moses. But he is not a forgotten man in heaven. He's not a forgotten man by the Lord. And you may feel forgotten in some ways in your life. But God has not forgotten you. God has a plan for you, just like he had a plan for Moses. He knows your name as we sing that song. He calls your name. He knows your name. And he has plans for you. And when he calls you, you have to answer. When I hear him say Chris, and sometimes he says Christopher, and then I really listen. He knows our name. Now, who was this that spoke from the bush? Verse 2 says that God called. Verse 2 actually says the angel of the Lord appeared to him in the bush. And then verse 4 says that God called to him from the midst of the bush. And I believe this is another one of those times which we call a Christophany. That is a pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus Christ. I think this was Jesus Christ speaking from the bush to Moses. Because the only one who could be an angel of the Lord or messenger from God and be God himself is Jesus Christ. He's God incarnate. So I believe that's a pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus. So he said, this is the Lord speaking, do not draw near this place. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place where you stand is holy ground. By the way, this is the first mention. And first mention in Scripture is an important principle. And this is the first mention of the word holy in the Bible. And it speaks of holy ground. The Lord tells him several things here. He says, don't draw near. Stop coming closer is the idea. It seems as though Moses was on his way for a close-up examination of the burning bush when God stopped him short and said, keep your distance. It was a holy place because God is holy. And you know, no matter what, there will always be a distance between God and man. Even in perfection, we will not equal God. This was the mistake that Eve listened to from the serpent, saying, "Eat of the fruit, for you'll be like God." It was also Satan's mistake in that he said, "I will become like the Most High God." We never become like God fully. But there's also the issue of the presence of God. You know, where we see here, he says, "Take your sandals off your feet." And this showing the right kind of humility, because poor and needy people have no shoes, in a sense. Servants went barefoot. But the presence of God, you know, in many cultures, when you come into someone's house, you take your shoes off. I remember when I was teaching in India, you take your shoes off when you go indoors of any kind. So when you go, we go up to the church building to speak, you know, you go in, before you go into the church building, you take your shoes off and you leave your shoes there. It's like, if you ever wanted to steal shoes, it's a great place to steal shoes. Because there's like tons of shoes. Most of them are just sandals and stuff. But, you know, you just, everybody's shoes are outside. But he turns aside to see the Lord, you know, and in the pathways of life, it should be a great thing, a season of life when God calls upon our life and we turn aside to see him, and then we come into his presence in a sense, and we sense his holiness. And in one sense, we sort of take our shoes off in the presence of the Lord. Verse 6, he says, "Moreover, he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God." He reminds him that he is the God of his forefathers, that he would reveal himself to Moses. And, you know, he would end up revealing himself to Moses even more than he did to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But he reminds him that he is coming to him based on the covenant that he had with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He is a covenant-keeping God. And Moses, we see, hides his face. He's struck with fear out of reverence in his presence. And again, Moses is the one writing this, saying that he's fear upon looking upon the face of God. He's afraid. See, Moses knew the holiness of God. And when you come to a place of humility and brokenness in your life and in my life, when we come to this kind of place, and I believe Moses is a very broken man. In fact, he will later write that Moses was the most humble man on the face of the earth. Now, I don't know how a man can write that. That's a confusing verse to me. Because as soon as you say they're the most humble man on the face of the earth, are you still humble? Right? But he does. He says that. But part of the reason he knew the holiness of God and he took his shoes off in the presence of God and he hid his face from God was because he was totally broken. You see, when you're not broken, when you're hard and when you're prideful, you'll stand and you'll sort of be in this place where you think, I can do what I want to do. And you'll stand up against God and you'll demand of God and you'll think that you can sort of command and demand things from God. And I see that sometimes in people, in arrogance. Thinking that even though they're not living for God, they're living in sin, even though they're not living right with God, that they'll start telling people of God how to live their lives and what to do with their lives. I had someone tell me how I'm supposed to listen to them, and they had a word from God for me, and I began to talk with them about their life and found out that they're not living for the Lord. Don't even really know if this person's a Christian. But they're going to tell me what I need to preach. That's what this person was doing. They're telling me what I need to preach to you folks. There's a great arrogance in that. That's not a humble person. A humble person, and this is the first time I ever had a conversation with this person too, but a humble person will just say, you know, I'm gonna take my shoes off. I'm in the presence of the Lord. Moses knew the holiness of God. He recognized it, and he hid his face. And the Lord said, verse 7, "I have surely seen the oppression of my people who are in Egypt and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows." He's aware. He knows their sorrows. He knows your sorrows. "So I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up from the land to a good and large land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Perizzites, and the Hivites and the Jebusites." He says he's going to come down. Now, and notice he says he's going to come down, but not because they deserve it, but because of his love for them, because of who he is. He's a covenant-keeping God. He knew them, and he heard their cry, and he simply is responding to their bondage. "Now, therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel has come up to me, and I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppressed them." Now is the time. You know, we talked this Sunday about the timing of God. He says, now therefore behold, the cry of them is coming. And he's going to begin to tell Moses how he's going to deliver his people. And now is God's timing. You know, it's not that he didn't see and hear their problems before this, but he's giving his attention to the matter now. And so verse 10, he says, come now, therefore, and I will send you to Pharaoh that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. He's telling him, this is his commissioning. He's commissioning Moses now. Now come. Verse 10 is very important. Therefore, and I will send you to Pharaoh. See, God could do this however he wanted to do it. He could have easily just had the Egyptians accept the children of Israel and say, you know what? We want to take you into your promised land. I mean, after all, you came from there in a famine, and now you've grown to a great nation, and we know you're busting out at the seams, and you don't fit here in Egypt, so let us just escort you to the promised land. We'll take you right through the wilderness, right into Kadesh Barnea. We'll enter into the gate. You'll be right there. It'll be great. God could have put that on the Egyptians' heart. God could have made that happen, but he didn't, because he wanted to build a nation who would follow him. And it's in persevering through the wilderness that these people will become a nation who follow their God as they learn about the pillar of cloud by day, pillar of fire by night. As they learn of this, as they see this, as they experience the things of the manna in the wilderness, as they experience the water coming from the rock, their experience with their walk with God through this is going to bring them to a place of knowing their God and trusting their God. And Moses is being sent by God to Pharaoh. He's not being sent to a side street to kill an Egyptian and bury him in the sand like he did before. God says, no, 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 you tried it your way. Now we're going to do it my way. I'm going to send you right to the top. I'm going to send you to Pharaoh. And then verse 11 is an amazing verse when you consider where Moses was at this point. He's on the backside of the desert. He's herding sheep. He's not really having a prominent life in God, it would seem. And God speaks to him from a burning bush, and he says, but, Moses said to God, it says, but, you know, isn't it amazing that we always say but to the Lord? When the Lord begins to tell us something that's difficult to hear, we all, but. And I'm amazed at God's patience with Moses and with me. When I say, but God, this isn't the way I thought it should go. I'm amazed that he hasn't smoked me. Because there's definitely been times I could say I deserved it. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and that I should bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? He thought he was the deliverer 40 years earlier. Now he says, who am I? 40 years earlier, he was like, I'm the man. Now he's like, who am I? I'm an old man. I'm 80 years old. I'm just a shepherd. See, he's come to the place of humility and brokenness that he cannot do this on his own. He has no confidence in himself at all, which is exactly where the Lord wants you to be. You know, when I talk to someone and they tell me they're interested in being involved in some sort of ministry, and I say to them, well, why don't you head up that ministry? They say, oh, no, I couldn't do that. That's the person I want. That's the person. You know what? I think you could do it. I think the Lord has made you just, he's broken you just right. We have to come to this place of brokenness. So the Lord answers them. He says, I'll certainly be with you, and this shall be a sign to you. See, it's not about you, Moses, it's about me. This will be a sign to you that I've sent you. When you've brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain. See, it's not about who am I, but it's about who he is. It's not about, oh, I can't. It's about what he can do. And he says, you're going to come back to this very place, this very mountain, and you're going to worship me there. And he would later worship him in this very place with these 2.5 to 3 million people witnessing that worship. Moses said to God, again, indeed, when I come to the children of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they say to me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? Now, indeed means, Lord, I want you to think about this now. That's sort of what he's saying. Did you ever consider that I don't know your name? What am I supposed to say about that name? What am I supposed to call you? I don't know your name. I'm going to go and I'm going to talk to people and I'm going to say, I saw a bush that wasn't consumed, and then I heard a voice from the bush, and it spoke to me. And they're going to go, right, Moses, I think the desert sun's gotten to you. And here's what he says. And God said to Moses, I am who I am. Well, that clears things up now, doesn't it? Thus you shall say to the children of Israel, I am has sent me to you. And this answer may not have helped Moses very much. I mean, you know, we don't know that he really understood what he was saying. And, you know, he is. Now he's going to go to Egypt. He's going to, okay, now I've got it. Okay, I'm not supposed to say Mr. Bush. Now I'm supposed to say, when they ask me about who you are, about who sent me, I'm supposed to say, I am sent me. And this I am that I am, I am who I am, he sent me to deliver you from the bondage of Egypt. And they're all just going to fall in line. And Moses does not have a whole lot of confidence in this. Now, as we look at this name of God, I am that I am, or I am who I am, it's something, you know, this is the best translation of it that we can come up with, I am that I am. But, you know, there is some things that we can talk about of what it potentially means, but it's not definitive, but it's in a sense this, I am the becoming one, I'm everything, I'm whatever I need to be, is the idea. And it's used throughout Scripture, I mean, where he says, Jehovah Jireh, I am your provider. Or when he says, Jehovah Rapha, I am your healer. Or like when he says to Gideon, Jehovah Shalom, I am your peace. Or to David, Jehovah Ra, I am your shepherd. Or to Jeremiah, Jehovah Tsidkenu, I am your righteousness. Or to Ezekiel, Jehovah Shammah, I am present. Or like Gabriel said to Mary that day that he would be called Jesus or Yeshua, I am becoming your salvation. And then we know that Jesus, I believe, took off on these very words when he said, I am the bread of life. I am the good shepherd. I am the light of the world. I am the way, the truth, and the life. I am the resurrection and the life. Before Abraham was, I am. And then on the night before he was crucified, as the soldiers came into the garden and they came to arrest him, John tells us that he stood up. And the wording in the gospel says, I am he said. But the he is in italics there. It really isn't in the original. He just stood up and said, I am. And they all fell down backwards, proving that no one would take him if he did not want to be taken, if he wasn't willing to give his life. He was not going to be taken. I am. With just the word, boom. And he could have called down legions of angels. Just tell them, Moses, I am sent you. That'll take care of it. That's enough. And it is enough, isn't it? And moreover, God said to Moses, thus you shall say to the children of Israel, the Lord God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name forever. And this is my memorial to all generations. You see, God is still the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. The God we worship, yes, he is known to us as Jesus Christ, God the Son. We worship God the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. But he is still the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Because notice what it says, this is my memorial to all generations. God is not cast off as ancient people. He is still the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And he still will work with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the last days. Verse 16, go and gather the elders of Israel together and say to them, the Lord God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and Jacob, appeared to me, saying, I have surely visited you and seen what is done to you in Egypt. And I have said, I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt to the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, Hivites, Jebusites, and all the other rites, to the land flowing with milk and honey. Now, it's interesting because in this, he uses the very same words that Joseph used in Genesis chapter 50, where it says, Joseph says, I'm dying, but God will surely visit you and bring you out of this land to the land which he swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So it's in a sense almost by these very words that they have probably heard passed down through Joseph, which has not yet been penned by Moses, but has been passed down by tradition. They knew these words from Joseph, no doubt. I have surely visited you and seen what has been done in Egypt. And God will surely visit you, Joseph said. They would recognize that Moses was sent by God, I believe, by those words. Then they will heed your voice, and you shall come, you and the elders of Israel, to the king of Egypt, and you shall say to him, the Lord God of the Hebrews has met with us, and now please let us go 3 days' journey into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. Now, this would not have been that unusual to the Egyptians because they would have gone out to the wilderness and sacrificed to their various gods at various times. So they're asking for this. He tells them to ask for this. But I am sure that the king of Egypt will not let you go, not even by a mighty hand. Now, isn't it interesting that God is giving him a commission? He's telling him what to do. He's saying, this is what I want you to do, but it's not going to work. I mean, he's not going to listen to you. It's going to take a lot of my judgment before this man begins to bow the knee. And he is not going to pay attention. He's not going to listen. And he says, so I'll stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all my wonders, which I will do in its midst. And after that, he will let you go. He's not going to just listen to your voice, Moses. It's not going to be by what you just say, but it's going to be by my power. It's going to be by what I do in their midst. And I will give you this people favor. I will give this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. And it shall be when you go that they shall go, not go empty-handed. But every woman shall ask of her neighbor, namely of her who dwells near her house, articles of silver, articles of gold, and clothing. And you shall put them on your sons and on your daughters. So you shall plunder the Egyptians. So here's a little side note. By the way, go to your neighbor and say, give me all your jewelry. And this is payment, I believe, for their wages for all those years of slavery. And that's what God is giving them. Chapter 4. We're going to go a little bit into chapter 4. Well, we're going to go a ways into chapter 4, I think. And Moses answered and said, and here we see more of Moses' sort of excuses. But suppose they will not believe me or listen to my voice. Suppose they say, the Lord has not appeared to you. Now, again, remember, Moses is talking to a bush. He knows the presence of God is there. He doesn't feel worthy to look at it, but he feels strong enough, and he has no problem arguing with the bush. I find that amusing. Moses has started making excuses as to why he shouldn't go. His first excuse, of course, was, who am I? And now he says, what if they don't believe me or listen to me? What if they say the Lord didn't come to you? What am I going to do? What am I going to do if they challenge me, he says. Did you ever think, Lord, did it ever cross your mind, Lord, that leadership wouldn't accept me? It's so funny. But in verse 18, God had already told him that they will heed your voice, but he's still questioning God. And that's so like us, that even when the Lord shows us something, confirms something, and shows us in our heart, there are just times when we'll just still go, but Lord, what about this? And we're like, we want to lay every scenario out to the Lord that could possibly be a problem with something. That's what Moses is doing here. So the Lord said to him, looks at him, and he says, what is that in your hand? Moses says, a rod. He's got his shepherd's staff in his hand. And you know, when you begin to look at this, it's a very detailed study. And in fact, Pastor Joe Foch does an incredible message on this very thing, if you ever want to look that up and listen to it. But it speaks of his work. A shepherd, his trust, his dependency was on his staff. Do you trust me enough to throw that down? What is your dependency? What do you trust in? What is in your hand, God would ask? What's in your hand tonight? Is it a computer? Is it a job? Is it your kids? What's in your hand? God says, cast it to the ground. So he cast it to the ground and became a serpent. Well, that worked real well, didn't it? And Moses fled from it. And listen, if I had something cast it to the ground and it becomes a snake, I'm running too, right? And the Lord said to Moses, reach out your hand and take it by the tail. Now, this is the wrong way. Kids, listen carefully. Do not pick up a snake by its tail. This is the wrong way to pick up a snake. And God's telling him to do something that's completely illogical, unconventional, even dangerous. But isn't that what faith is about sometimes? Now, by the way, faith isn't always about doing something unconventional, illogical, and dangerous. So it's not like you should look for the unconventional, illogical, and dangerous and say, oh, that must be faith. But there are times when faith is this way. And verse 5 says that they may believe that the Lord God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has appeared to you, that you might know this. He says, furthermore, the Lord said to him, now put your hand in your bosom, verse 6. And he put it there, his hand in his bosom. He took it out. Behold, his hand was leprous like snow. So he puts his hand in there, and he takes it out, and it's leprous. Now he says, put your hand in the bosom again. And he takes it out, and he drew it. And behold, it was restored like the other flesh. He says, then it will be, if they do not believe you, nor heed the message of the first sign, they'll believe the message of the latter sign. See, the sign is to prove that God is all that Israel needs. He's the God of power and control over sickness and over disease, over every problem they have. The plagues that would come later prove this, that God is in control of all those things. And it shall be, if they do not believe even these two signs or listen to your voice, that you shall take water from the river and pour it on the dry land. And the water which you take from the river will become blood on the dry land. Now, the Nile River was considered by the Egyptians to be a god. They worshiped the Nile River. And so he would take water from the Nile and pour it on to the ground and become blood. But they'd been using this very river for blood as they were throwing babies into the river and killing the babies. Much like our own nation is doing today. Well, we're not doing it in the river. We're doing it in cleansed clinics. So God says to him, take that rod, throw down that rod, throw down that very thing. And you know, he says, what is in your hand? What do you have in your life? And God says this over and over. He says to that little shepherd boy, what is in your hand? He says, a sling. I'm going to take that sling and I'm going to use it to slay a giant. What's in your hand? Moses, the staff, the rod, shepherd boy with a sling. Look how God uses these things. Moses' next excuse, verse 10. Oh, my Lord, I am not eloquent, neither before or since you have spoken to your servant, but I am slow of speech and slow of tongue. The Lord said to him, who made of your mouth? I always think that should be in Italian, you know, kind of like that. Who made your mouth? Who makes the mute and the deaf and the seeing and the blind? Have not I the Lord? Now therefore go and I'll be with your mouth and teach you what you should say. I'm going to speak through you, Moses says. God will put the words in your mouth. And I often will have people tell me, well, I don't think I can speak. I don't think I can do this. Listen, the Lord will give you the words to say. If you're diligent, you're in his word, he'll give you the words to say in whatever situation you need to be in. In fact, Jesus said in Matthew 10, but when they deliver you up, do not worry about how or what you should speak, for it'll be given you in that hour of what you should speak. For it is not you who speak, but the Spirit of your Father who speaks in you. Now, by the way, that doesn't mean you shouldn't study and you shouldn't be in the Word and you don't need to worry about that. What that means is if you've hidden the Word in your heart, it's going to just come out naturally. Moses is like, well, you know, I can't talk. I'm stutterer. Who made your mouth? Verse 13, he says, oh, my Lord, please send by the hand of someone else you may send. You know, Moses had mellowed so much in the wilderness, he didn't even want to go now. He's looking for a substitute. He wants to get out of this. Lord, send somebody else, anybody else. And it says, the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses. And he said, is not Aaron the Levite your brother? I know that he can speak well. And look, he is coming out to meet you. When he sees you, he will be glad in his heart. See, though the Lord is angry with Moses, he has patience with Moses. Isn't that wonderful? Because aren't there times when you know the Lord's upset with you, like he's angry with you? There's times when you're like, you know what? I know I've gone too far with this. I've asked too many questions. But he's still patient with him. Now you shall speak to him and put the words in his mouth, and I'll be with your mouth and with his mouth, and I will teach you what you shall do. And so he shall be your spokesman and to the people, and he himself shall be as a mouth for you, and you shall be to him as God. And you shall take his rod, this rod in your hand with which you shall do the signs. So Moses went and returned to Jethro, his father-in-law, and said to him, please let me go and return to my brethren who are in Egypt and see if they are still alive, whether they're still alive. And Jethro said to Moses, go in peace. The Lord is with him. You know, the Lord is leading him, but he's still wondering whether he really, like, I'm almost wondering if he didn't think he had a dream or something. Let me go see if they're still alive. The Lord has told him they're still alive. The Lord has told him that he's heard their cries coming from Egypt, but Moses still questions it. The great questions of chapters 3 and 4.